in. So the first thing I want you to do, and this is not really optional, is that you find these lecture slides. You have the URL on top of there, or you can go to the previous slides and change the number from 1 to 2. So I told you last time that you have to bring a laptop or cell phone or iPad or whatever device that you can use to browse the slides. And this is because we have these lecture questions embedded in the slides, which you need to answer in order to pass the course. So step one, find your laptop. If you don't have a laptop, find a friend that has a laptop. Then log in. And then the third task, find at least two or three friends. So make groups of three or four people. Now, this is not an optional thing. This is how I teach. So you have to have at least two friends in, after two slides. But before we actually start this lecture, there are still some people who do not have a group or are working alone and don't want to be working alone. So raise your hand if you want to work in a group but don't have a group at this point. There's one, two, three. Congratulations, four. You are now a group of four students. So join up and make up your schedules. And if group size four is too much, you can have, work in pairs, make two groups of two. And if you still don't have a group because you were too shy to raise your hand, go to the Slack and ask there. There are probably other people there, and you can have them join you. And just to remind you, working in groups is very helpful, but it's not mandatory. Only time when you have to work in groups is during the lectures. Doesn't have to be your work group, can be just a random two or three people. So, okay, everyone found the web page. Okay, then find few friends that are sitting next to you. And then we can actually go on and continue. First order of business. If anyone has grievances in the course, so you have, troubles and are not really comfortable or something like this, Antti-Juhani has made this feedback form. Would you please shut up? Thank you. Made this feedback form where you can, submit your innermost thoughts. They are completely anonymous. They are one step away from me. They go to Antti-Juhani, who processes them and is not in charge of the course politics and so on. So if you just got annoyed because I said shut up, then you can use this form to give feedback. Goes to Antti-Juhani, and Antti-Juhani will be very angry at me and say that you can't tell people to shut up. It's impolite. And that's how we get this nice circle and the course improves. Okay? Everyone got that? Great. So there's a link, and you don't have to do it now. It will be open for the whole course. Okay, so topics for today. I got few excellent questions from you, and I thought I'd make a few slides of these questions. Then I have a small tip of how you study in this course, how you get the most out of this course. Then we have these actual topics. We find out what is a notional machine, why we are doing these, deduce by hand what this expression is all about exercises. And then we discuss about the differences between statements and expressions. Java is a language that is focused on statements, and Haskell is a language that is focused on expressions. So that is one crucial difference between the languages that you have to find out. Then we go and discuss a bit about Haskell syntax and what is a variable. Variable is another great difference between functional programming. It's totally different to, C or Java programming. The concept of variable, it's not the same concept at all. Haskell is a bit closer to the mathematics point of view, and Java is a bit closer to the, computer point of view, or registers and memory slots and so on. So that is our agenda. Any comments or... Yes?
It says that the hold on a second.
Yeah.
Both the
Okay, well,
yeah, I think you already fixed it.
Okay, I fixed something. That's awesome. Okay, no other comments about the agenda, so we can proceed. First, these awesome questions that I received from you. First question is there an IDE or debugger in Haskell? Well, we work mainly using a text editor and so on, so this is a very relevant question. If you have Java or C Sharp, you really need an IDE or you are basically, you know, stuck. It's very hard to work with these languages if you don't. And yeah, we have debuggers and IDEs for Haskell. And the sad truth is that they are not nearly as good as Visual Studio or Eclipse or tools like this. If you want to try them out, there's tools called Lexa and Intero. You have links on the slide, so you can check these out. They are not really all that useful for our course. We do very small programs, so they don't yet have a very big benefit for you. Then there's two, you know, IDE light tools for Haskell. GHID and this stack build filewatch command. And these basically are programs that you run in one terminal, and they continuously compile your programs and basically present you with a view of all errors in your program. So when you are working in, you know, moderately sized programs, these will help enormously. And when you are working with large programs, you probably want to try out these IDEs. And there is a debugger inside GHI. You can type help, and it will tell you how to use it. I have used that once. I have never found use for that tool except for one time. So I guess it won't be very useful for you either, but you can try it. It's there and it works. So the question that comes up is, how on earth can a programmer live without a good debugger or debugging tool? And yeah, if I do JavaScript or C Sharp or Java, I spend something like 60% of my time looking at the debugger window. Just that is how you work in these languages. However, in Haskell, like I said, I don't actually use the debugger at all. Well, I have this GHI, which is an interpreter that I can continuously use to test my small expressions. I write small thing, see how it works, put it in my code file, write the next expression, check if it works, put it in the code file. So in practice, GHI takes, you know, about 80% of the need for debugger away from me. Trying it code there just gives me a clear impression what it's doing, and I don't need a debugger. Then there is this point that Haskell functions are really independent. They only work according to their parameters. So you feed something in the function, that is the only thing that the function uses to compute the value. So it can't depend on anything else, which allows me to test small individual functions, and I don't need a debugger to test the whole system that much. And, well, only place where you actually would like to have a debugger is when you interact with external components like databases or, you know, web services or things like this. Because then you have this dependency to external world, which might behave in a different way than you expect. And then you might consider using the GHI debugger. And finally, you know, 10% of all the things that I would use debugger in JavaScript or Java goes away because I have Haskell type system. That just eats away the things I need to debug. Okay, sorry about debugger. I don't remember who asked me this, but this was a great question, so I thought I would share the answer for all of you. Second question, I think from that end of the classroom, someone asked me if there is runtime errors in functional programming. And unfortunate truth, if you are doing programming with any language, you always interact with the real world and you always have some sort of a, you know, runtime error possibility. Can't really avoid it at all. This Elm language, which I use to write the exercises, that basically is 100% proof of, you know, not having runtime errors, unless you use JavaScript or JavaScript components in your Elm program. And JavaScript, of course, has runtime errors, so yeah, you always get them. With Haskell, the situation is a bit worse, since the basic prelude library that you load every time you make a Haskell program, it's really old. It's been used for, what, 20 years or so. It's very hard to change because all Haskell programs in the world depend on that library. So you change that, you break all Haskell programs. So not a very good value proposition. And that basic library is, you know, it contains a lot of bad functions, partial functions, things that will give you runtime errors if you use them. So our policy in this course, you can't use partial functions during the course. This is an excellent policy if you go to work in some company. You never want a runtime error. The runtime error happens when the software is deployed on your customer's computer. You can't go there and debug, so you're basically screwed if this happens. So we try to learn during this course to avoid all of these nasty functions. Here is an example list. Function head, that's a function that extracts the first element of the list. And of course, that explodes if you give it an empty list. Tail takes all but the first element. That also explodes on empty lists. Same last element, starting part of the list, functions minimum and maximum. These are all, you know, these are all going to fail if you pass them an empty list. So don't use these. With head and tail, use the case statement. It is always better. Last and init, you never have to use these functions. I mean, realistic use cases are very rare for both of them, so just throw them away. And if you want minimum or maximum, use this module called data.save. That provides you with minimum and maximum functions with reasonable type signatures, which don't give you runtime errors. And basically, you know, if I see this on an exercise, I will fail that exercise. Because if you learn to use these in your code, you will have troubles in the real world. So do yourself a favor, stop using these. And I'm sad that Haskell even has these functions, shouldn't have, but because of history, it does. Okay, any questions about this? I really liked this question because... Yeah, okay, yes.
Mm-hmm. Your lecture note, but I found from the Learn You Haskell how to load scripts,
yeah.
And I found it very useful, so I think you should mention it.
Yeah, I will add that to the course material, I think. Yeah. Please remind me, because when I lecture, I forget everything else.
I don't know if anyone else finds it useful, but
I think it's something that's definitely useful. Please email me, and I'll make sure it's added somewhere. So, then... Those were the great questions that I received from you. And now I will give you a pro tip for studying. I didn't know this tip, and it took me something like 5 years to get my master's degree, but it basically sucks. So for this course, there's this self-test that you should do right about now. There are five points here, and I will translate them for you. The first point is that I actually studied the material for this lecture that you are now sitting in. That's one point. Second point is that you studied Haskell for at minimum 30 minutes each day last week. That gives you another point. Third point you get if you got a Haskell book. I gave you a list of Haskell books that are nice. You actually went out and got that book. One of them is actually free, so it's not costing you any money even. And you browsed through the book. That's the third point. Fourth point is that you actually have a study group. And fifth point, you did at least one exercise outside of the supervised sessions. Okay, these are the five points that you can get. Now count how many points you each got. You don't have to say it aloud, but just make this mental note, I got 4 points or 3 points. If you get more than 3 points, you are good to go. You are going to pass this course and there's no trouble for you at all. So just keep doing this and you're all set. If you get 3 or less points, then this is a bit like you are running a marathon within wearing rubber boots. Of course, you can do it. You can pass the course, but it's going to be more difficult than necessary. And basically, if you got less than 3 points, you know, there's, you know, 5 ideas that you can improve your studies here. So just pick up a few more items and start doing these weekly. I think most controversial is the point number 2. I say that you have to study 30 minutes each day, including Saturday and Sunday and Monday and so on. And this might sound like, you know, horrible idea, study every day. However, the 30 minutes, it's very small amount of time. And since you get this continuous study, you don't forget things between your study sessions. If you study only on weekends, you study on Saturday or Sunday only, there's going to be 5 days between the study sessions. And you are most likely going to forget almost everything you studied in the previous weekend by the next one. So this is something that will significantly increase your learning and increase your potential of passing this course. Okay. Everyone agree with me with this? Yeah, just do these and you pass the course. It's so easy. Okay, then the tip. Is anyone familiar with the Seinfeld technique? This is an excellent mind hack. It basically works like this. You go and get yourself a calendar. You print out a calendar page or whatever. Then you go in and cross out all those days that you, you know, did 30 minutes of Haskell and functional programming. And you are going to get this long string of crossed out days. And that is, for some reason, very motivational for most people. So it provides you with very easy goal. You know, you can, you know, 30 minutes, it's so little, you can just, you know, hold your breath for 30 minutes almost. So why not study Haskell for 30 minutes? When you get this long string of crosses, you know that I'm doing really well and I'm not going to skip one day because it's going to ruin this beautiful long line of crosses. And it multiplies together. So if you keep studying, you study 30 minutes longer than your friends, you are going to be so far ahead of your friends after the course. Okay. Everyone cool with this? Pick up this technique. I actually use this and it's really motivational. It makes me do things that I wouldn't do otherwise. And final note about the course and topics. We have for a few years tried to monitor how difficult our exercises is. And here is actual learning curve of this course. I'm not going to explain it in more detail, except to say that if you're having difficulties with some exercise, bring up this slide and you can actually check the plot. Say you are having difficulties with exercise product. You see it's not really that difficult. So you go and ask a TA what's going wrong. Then you are having troubles with exercise called simple type driven. Yeah, you are supposed to be having troubles with this. This has historically been very difficult exercise. So you can spend more time with that. Okay, clear. Just pick up the slide and you can check how difficult this should be. All right, long interlude of things that are not so important. Now, what we are going to do next? We are going to use this fancily termed teaching technique called peer instruction, which is taking the academic world with some, not by a storm, but many people are using it. It's a teaching technique that has been widely studied. There are hundreds of publications on this. And it actually, in each of these publications, demonstrably increases student learning. So it's a nice technique. It's so popular that even the popular media is writing about this. And how this works, you have to have 3 or 4 person groups. In a short while, I will explain you, make a question on the slides. There's going to be a multiple choice question that you can cross out true, false, and things like this. Then you think for a few minutes by yourself, what is the answer for this question? Check it in the slides. Then usually my exercise system is going to break and we are going to, you know, have troubles there, but hopefully not. After you checked in your answer, everyone has done that, we see how many of you answered in which way you answered. Then you make your groups and you try to convince the other members of your group that your answer is correct. And we spend a few minutes doing that. And then we answer again and see how the results change. And if there's need for more clarification, I will explain the exercise. Okay, is this clear? Very simple. And yeah, it's going to be a bit weird at the first, but I promise you it actually will work if you read the material before the lecture. Anyone unduly worried about this? No? Okay, let's try. And I have to reload. If you log in and it doesn't show you the widget, you have to reload the page. It's still a bit old. Now, first question. I have code like this. Haskell code. It's supposed to calculate something. And now you have to figure out what is actually the result of this function call. First, we think 1 minute, you know, what is going to happen here, and check in our answers. And if you have troubles, you don't have a computer or anything that you could use to answer these questions, find a friend and who has a computer and pop open some incognito mode in the browser, and you can use your friend's computer. You can log in a separate window. Okay, everyone ready with this? Checked in the answer. Who is still working? Hands up. A few people. Let's give 15 more seconds. And now I'm actually very stressed out because I have no idea if this polling system is going to work. If it doesn't work, my whole lecture, you know, is going to suck badly. Okay, now I guess everyone has answered. Okay, we have this kind of a graph. Green bars mean that 20 people agreed with the first statement. 20 people think that it produces the value 0. 3 people don't know, don't have any idea whether it produces 0 or not. And 9 people think that it won't produce value 0. And same for all of these bars. And mostly everyone seems to be on agreement that it's not going to produce 1, 2, or 3. So the question is, does it produce 6? Or 0. Now, discuss with your friends and try to argument on your viewpoint. If you think it produces 6, make your friends also believe that it produces 6. Few minutes and... Make a note soon. Okay, who needs more time? Hands up. Do you need more time? Okay, So now, check in your answers. If your group managed to convince you of a different answer, check it in, and we'll see how things work. And click. Yeah. Comparing the previous result, let's see if I need to update. No. You know, about a third of you thought that, you know, it's going to produce 6. And, you know, now only very few people think it's going to produce 6. Okay, why do most of you think that it's going to produce the number 0? Yes?
Because if you just keep on boxing the whole thing, eventually you just reach a point where you have to multiply everything by 0, which you don't reach just 0.
Yeah, exactly what you said. At some point, there is going to be 0 in this multiplication, and it's going to zero out everything. Multiply anything with 0, it's going to be 0. Okay, then there was another question. I threatened you in the last lecture that you have to answer at least 30% of these exercises correctly. And this is a soft threat. If you really don't participate and you get everything wrong, I will be probably failing you for the course. So this rule is only there because I really, really want you to study the course material before the lectures. So in theory, you have to get at least 30% of these questions correct, either in the first round or in the second round. And if you are going to get only something like 28% correct, I'm going to let it slide. But if you get, you know, none of them correct, then I will make your life a bit more difficult somewhere. Everyone cool with this? This 30% is really a low bar for everyone. But it's high enough that you actually have to study the course material. But okay, that was our first peer instruction question. So, was it okay for you? So at least I think we have, you know, small learning effect. 14 people changed their minds. And the whole point about this peer instruction is that, you know, when you hear it from your peers, it's going to be in your language and easier for you to understand than my explanation. Yes, there's a question. Okay, mä annan vähän enemmän aikaa. Okay, final note about the peer instruction questions for those who are not present in the classroom. So if you are a remote student, you have to answer to these questions, and you have to give me something like 50 to 100 words for each question that I present during the lecture. And I do not want to hear about, well, this was wrong, this was right, this was right. I want to hear why these were right or why these were wrong. So the actual answer, yes, no, it's not interesting. You have to make 50 words of, you know, justification for why these things are the way they are. The justification is the important part, not the actual answers. But that doesn't concern anyone in this classroom, so we can go on. So what is the, you know, why did I have this kind of a question? Never assume anything about code. Otherwise, you will get bugs. Here you have this very suggestive name, at least if you are Finnish speaker. It says that it's going to calculate the product. Yet the definition is, you know, not doing that at all. So names in your programs, they don't have any kind of a meaning. You can't ever trust the names in your programs. You trust the equations and the types, but not the names. Okay, next topic. This is about anyone know what a notional machine is? Okay, so in the old days when you had computers like C64 and these very small and very fun computers, programmers actually knew what happens inside the computers. They knew exact position of all bits in the computer. Nowadays we have these huge machines that are running parallel and are stochastic and whatever, and we really can't know what happens in the PC. It's so hugely complex that we would have to spend all our lives trying to understand how the processor works. And then you swap from Intel to AMD and it all changes. So how can we actually program a computer because it's so complex? And one theory is that we are not actually programming that computer, we have this mental image of a computer in our heads. This simplified image that is just enough similar to the actual computer that we can simulate that in our head. And then, you know, program that computer and the real computer works in a similar way. Now, biggest part of this course is trying to build this notional machine of Haskell language inside your heads. So you can simulate and, you know, do judgments based on that machine. So you know how to write programs. Now, we have found that there are, in every intake, we have few students that never acquire a notional machine in their heads. These are brilliant people, hardworking people, but they really, you know, can't simulate the computer in their heads. And this is perfectly reflected on the Harry Potter movies. The Harry Potter movies are an abominable way of presenting university world. There is Harry Potter, and what is he learning in university? You flick your hand like this and say like this, and then something happens. And some people, you know, do this in programming one. There's this Vesa Lappalainen, who is waving his hand around, writing something, 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 and something's happened. And people think that, yeah, it's a movement of the hand and those words. And then they want to calculate product of three numbers and go while, if, int zero. And nothing happens. Even though Vesa actually used those same words. There's something missing, however. You can't memorize programs, so you have to build, you know, a notional machine inside your heads. And one of the primary techniques in our course is to, you know, calculate things by hand. So we compute by hand, we observe the rules, how Haskell works, and, you know, we learn how it works, and then we have the machine in our head. Yeah, you remember this table testing. This sounds horribly like table testing in programming one. I don't know if they even have this anymore there because it's so horrible. If you do this in, you know, Java, you get code like this. If you are an experienced Java programmer, you can probably guess what this does by just looking at the shape of it. If you really want to find out what this thing does, well, you have to, you know, take your pen and a paper and start computing this huge matrix. Just I'm going to go in line one, and then I get numbers variable. It's like this. In line two, something happens. Line three, something happens, and so on. And I can't imagine a worse pastime for a human. I mean, this is why computers were invented. This is horrible to do. But you actually have to do it if you don't, you know, recognize the big pattern of the code. And the big problem is when you are starting out as a programmer, you can't recognize the big patterns. So we have to look at these individual Lego blocks, and like we did before in Haskell, we have these rules. Haskell differs from Java in that it doesn't have a state. At least in, you know, simple Haskell expressions, you don't have a state. So you take a program, an expression, and manipulate that expression by the rules given. Then you get a new expression. You manipulate that with the rules given, and it's like working on a simple calculation in, you know, your school. You know, that's what you did in school. It's not all that different. And I think the notional machine in Haskell is way simpler than the one in Java. You just have these rules and apply these rules. You don't have to make these tables about how the program state changes as a function of time. So this is why we have these calculate by hand exercises. They are mechanical, they are boring, and you actually don't have to do them if you completely understand what is happening. But until then, they are excellent way of practicing how Haskell notional machine works. Okay, I have a notional machine question for you. If you are going to compute this expression using these definitions, what is going to be the next step? Does this immediately reduce to true, false, or does it reduce to both true, false, true? And first, just spend a few minutes thinking silently what this is about. Most of you, I think, actually did the exercise already, so you somehow know what is going on. We could have this additional rule. After you have answered, look up on the slides and take a relaxed position so I can see what is your progress during this. Otherwise, it's hard for me to gauge what is happening. Seuraava askel. Next step. Okay, I think there's only three choices. Who is in the middle of thinking still? Yeah, think. Okay, most of you are looking up on the slides. So, even if you are still in progress, it doesn't matter. I can show you what your friends think. Okay. Almost everyone is certain that it's not going to be true. Yep, that I think we can take as a given. And most of you think that it's going to be this, both true, false, true. You're going to take one step in the program, you're going to get this. And there's a bunch of people who think that you go directly to false. Okay, cool. Yeah, the ratios seem to be somewhat stable. So, next. Ask your friends. Is there some kind of a dog buried in this exercise? Is there a trick?
Next
step, not the final one. Okay. The immediate next.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Is it clearing up? Are you managing to convince your friends about your answer? So hands up if you still need more time. No hands are going up, so click in your answer. So check in your answer now. Yeah, check in. Yeah, okay. I think this is something I actually need to explain to you, because the next immediate step is false. There's 16 people here who think this is actually false. Any of you 16 guys care to explain why it's going to be false and not both true, false, true? And correct answer from back row. So what's happening here? Haskell is a lazy language. It doesn't compute things unnecessarily. So there is this pattern, both true, whatever, false. Of course, in the exercise I had you to do, you have also this case that if there's truths and so on. So what happens here? You start fitting all these patterns to this expression that you have. And first pattern that fits is this both true. It says both true, whatever value, it's going to be false. So, well, whatever value, it's going to be false. Because why would we compute this expression? Regardless of what it says here, it's not going to change the end result. So we go directly to the false. And this doesn't change if you add the other clause of the both true there. So if you write both true, true is equal to true, and both true in any other case is false, it still is going to do the same thing. So Haskell computes only by demand. And since both true accepts whatever value you give it, it's not going to actually compute the arguments. This is the big difference between C-sharp, Java, and Haskell. Both in C-sharp and Java, you always evaluate your arguments first before passing on them on to the function. In Haskell, you evaluate them when you need to. Okay, clear? So this is, you might want to try out programs like this. You can actually try these things out by writing error and some string in place of the thing that you want to check if this gets evaluated. You basically crash your program if it evaluates something, and then you see if your program crashes. I can demonstrate that in the supervised sessions if you like. Okay, any questions about this? This is a tricky thing. Yeah, it's not going to be actually terribly important if you calculate this in a wrong order. It's something that you will need when you make larger Haskell programs, but not during this course so much. So then, a few example peer instruction questions, few about this notional machine, few about not assuming things. One of the big difficulties in teaching Haskell is teaching Haskell syntax. In Java, you have parentheses and commas everywhere. It's very easy to read. Haskell syntax is very fluid. Function application, it's just white space. So it's pretty hard to actually see what is a parameter for what. And since functions return other functions, it's somewhat hard to read as a beginner. When you get adjusted to Haskell syntax, it's actually extremely nice syntax to work in. But at your current level of development, you probably will have troubles with it. So let's see the most difficult part in Haskell syntax. That is that we have to recognize that Haskell works only with expressions and very rarely with statements. So first bit terminology. A thing like this. This is pretty much similar that you would find in Java or other languages like this. This is an assignment statement. It's a statement, it's something that gets executed the computer does this and then ends up in a new state. You have these in Haskell, but you have in smaller proportion than in Java. Then you have expressions. These are the things that the language is computing. It's not executing, it's computing these. So anything that is, you know, looks like arithmetic, is a function call, whatever, this is an expression. And most part, everything in this course will be about expressions, meaning that we get a long, large, huge expressions, and we are going to nest expressions inside other expressions, arising the difficulty of the Haskell syntax. And finally, we have third related concept, which is a definition. Here is a definition for value f, or function f, if you will. So these three things, well, elementary Haskell syntax, you have to be able to separate these from each other. And, well, elementary, so basically we are looking at individual Lego blocks right now and how these fit together. We are not going to get to Elsa's castle until, you know, week 8 or so. So we are still looking at these small atomic Haskell pieces. So let's see if we got this. And I really don't know if I have too many questions. If we do, we skip some of them. But okay, based on this previous explanation, this is a great measure of my, you know, didactic abilities, by the way. Explain something and ask immediately if you got it. Which of these are expressions? Just a quick check to see if you got this at all. We don't do the group part for this one. Just checking if you got these. Actually, I think we are going to do the group part for the final one. Yeah, they are always going to be multiple choice. Just the easiest way for me to do this. If someone wants to, you know, code up more interesting questions like drawing lines or something, I'm happy to accept that code, but I'm not going to write it myself. Okay, I think half and half are looking up. It doesn't harm you if I check how many of you answered already. About all of you. So, I think, is there anything that actually... Yeah, there is actually need for this group discussion, I think. First, this one I think we can discard, because, well, I just showed you an example of this being a statement. It is executing some command and, you know, binding the result of the command to some value. Then we have this let thingy, which is, you know, half and half. You know, half of you think it's actually an expression, half you think not. Then we have this. This is a type declaration. It's a declaration, so it's not going to be an expression. And this is a definition. It's defining the symbol quadratic to be a function of three parameters and something. And then you have this if statement. And also this is like half and half. So a good test for, you know, checking if something can be an expression is write something like 1 plus and then the thing behind this plus. You know, add parentheses if necessary. If this makes sense, then it's going to be an expression. Of course, you know, if this expression is of some non-numerical type, it's not so sensible, but, you know, oh, in theory, could you write your expression in this place? Could you say 1 plus let blah, blah, blah? Or could you say 1 plus if blah, blah, blah? And let's have a short discussion about this. It's a minor point, but probably better to get it clear once and for all. Okay, short discussion, not very long discussion, so we don't run over time so badly.
Onko täällä määritelty X tuossa jossain termissä määritelty?
Okay, I think it's time to vote. You know, if you got convinced that you were wrong before, just check in your answer now and we see. It's not supposed to require so much deduction. This is about making a quick judgment of whether this thing is or is not. So, everyone has submitted something. And yeah, exact nice effect. We had, you know, 50-50, and now we have, you know, yes, yes, very strongly. So, let is an expression. You can write something like let x be in x, and then say something like this. Let is an expression. It's very different in Java because you don't have this way of binding variables inside your expressions. In Java, you really don't need the capability of doing this because you never have these huge expressions where you want to give names to sub-expressions. In Haskell, our program is one huge expression, so we need that. Also, if I have something like this, ifs. Ifs are not statements. In Java, they are statements. In Haskell, they are expressions. So if it's just something, it's part of an expression, you reduce it to a value and so on. Which has interesting corollary. I can never omit the else part. In Java, I can throw the else away. But in Haskell, you know, this does not make any sense. One plus if something is true, then one. And if it's not true, then, you know, what? Can I make the font bigger? Yeah, I can make the font bigger. About one. Yeah, and appearance. Big enough.
Yeah.
So without the else part, it's always nonsensical. You can never omit else, because with Java you can. It's a statement. It doesn't execute anything if there's, you know, if false and missing else part. It just skips the execution. Doesn't do anything. In Haskell, it can't skip because there must be some value that you get out of the expression, so you can use it in other parts of the larger expression it's embedded in. Okay, this clear for all of you. Yeah. Okay. Then, you know what is an expression. Now, how do you get in trouble with expressions? Is that you have these nested expressions. So you have something like this. You have one expression inside another expression, which is inside a third expression. And you have lots of parentheses, floating around. And that's hard to read. That's not hard to read in, say, 2 months, the time you have practiced Haskell enough, it's immediate. But, for now, it's quite easy to get confused. Where do I put the parentheses? It's something that you have to really think about at this point. And there is a trick for this. So if you have this huge expression, you have multiple steps, you feed some value through many, 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 many functions, there is a way you can do this easier. So you can actually not do this. You can eliminate all need for parentheses with a simple trick. Use the let statement. So if you have a blah. What is copy paste on Windows? I have no idea. Yeah, I have no idea how to use Windows. So let's make something else. So what do we have here? Well, I'm not going to execute this statement, so I'm going to have these undefined variables. There's lista, which is some kind of list, contains whatever. And like you can see, I already forgot some parentheses. If you see that you are writing something like this, you can mechanically start modifying this. You can instead write it like this. And I apologize for not having line breaks at my disposal right now. So I have to write this all in one line. It makes it a bit more messy than it's supposed to, but I can do it like this. I can use a let statement. Say, my first step, the thing I do very firstly is, sort by. So I'm sorting a list. I have some operation that I'm using to sort a list. Then what is this operation? Well, let's give that a name also. So comparing length. And if I'm making typos or mistakes, don't worry about this. It's very hard to talk and type code at the same time. Okay, now I have this step one. I sort something. Then step two is take the results of step one and apply them to these. Write the final expression there. And finally, we compute step two, which is the final expression. So you can, instead of making these nested statements, you can work by, giving names for all of your sub expressions in this thing. So you have this comparing length, and it's actually wrong on the first line. Shows you why it's really hard to get this correct. You can define op, which is something. First step, you do something first. Second step, you do something then. Third step, you do something. And finally, you compute the final step in your sequence. So, and when you are using a text editor, instead of the semicolon, you have a line break, which makes it very readable. It actually looks a bit like Java or related language. If you do this, you don't have to worry about parentheses. It's like you have these training wheels on. So if you have a hard time with expressions, do this. It's an excellent trick. After a while, you are going to be too lazy to do this, and it's going to be okay. Then you know how to write the expressions. And yeah, I had one parenthesis in the wrong place. It's supposed to be like this. So play with that. Try this out after the lecture. It's a very nice technique if you have trouble with stuff like this. Okay, any questions? Probably my explanation wasn't very good, but you try it and then you figure out how it works. Then another thing that is really going to bite you, most of you at least, is that when we write function calls, in Java we have function name, parentheses, arguments within the parentheses. Very easy to read. In Haskell we have, function name, whitespace, argument, whitespace, argument, which is very nice to write, very nice to read when you know how to read it, but at the beginning it really sucks. So the rule here is that if you have a function call like this, all things after the function name are going to be arguments for the function, except operators. Operators end the argument list for functions. So, for example, this thing here. There is an operator here. There's this division. So 0 and pi, they are arguments for Atan, but divided by 4 is not an argument to Atan. So in Java, this would be something like this. So,
question.
Yes?
If you look at Atan and it takes one argument in, and when you look at Atan 2 and it takes two arguments, so what's the... like 0 and pi just considered one argument, or...
Yeah, okay. Firstly, you are right. I should have Atan 2 here. And what is the difference between Atan and Atan 2 functions? Anyone know? Oh, okay. This is a bit technical and it's rather impromptu question, so I don't know if my explanation is going to be right.
The point is the arguments, how many arguments it takes.
Yeah. Okay, the intuitive explanation is that you usually use this function to calculate angle between some things. And now Atan only gives you the first quadrant of angles. So if your angle is going to spin around the circle, it's going to flip it back. Atan 2 takes this into account, so you can get angles like 179 degrees. Antti-Juhani, am I correct with this? Maybe. Okay, we accept this answer. Everyone look up Atan 2 function in Wikipedia and you'll figure it out. So, what this results into? This kind of an expression. I'm pretty sure that every one of you, when you see this tomorrow or some other day in Haskell code, are going to think that, yeah, Atan is going to take, two arguments, and the first argument is this, and the second argument is pi divided by 4. You can't really help this. You have to always stop and think. And how this manifests in, the practice or supervised sessions? I kid you not, this happens in every supervised session, in every year, in every functional programming course. Someone writes something like this. So you are defining this some function that we know so very well already, and you write this, except you forget the parentheses around this part. So what we are actually writing here is not the definition of function sum. We are trying to redefine this operator cons, these two dots on top of another. We are defining this operator. And our syntax is bad because we have this sum x, which is not really a nice parameter name. So it's completely changing the reading of the statement. So the parentheses would go around this part and this part. So be extra careful with this. If you have function calls, things that look like function calls, and operators, just put the parentheses in there. Put the parentheses in places you think they are, and then the compiler will understand you. Otherwise, you get this mistake. And if you, get this mistake, it's not a biggie, you fix it and go on. But that's one of the pain points. Okay, I'm going to skip this. Sorry, I don't have time, and I think that every one of you can figure it out. Remote students don't have to answer it either. And we get to this most difficult topic in the first functional programming course. This is the horridly difficult principal operator thing that I force everyone to go through at least once. So the idea of reading Haskell is that, you know, when you are faced with this huge Haskell expression, there's always a way to split your problem into smaller subproblems. So all of these Haskell expressions have a simple shape, very simple shape. For example, I have some function call plus some function call, and the shape I'm talking about is something plus something, meaning that you would put parentheses here and here. Similarly, if I have a function call, the shape is some function call with some argument. And if I have this situation where, you know, I'm calling a function and dividing, well, we already know from the previous slide that parentheses go here and here. So it's something divided by something. And then if I have this, you know, huge let statements, the operators, you know, basically let x be something in some expression. The idea is that the clouds represent the sub-expressions of the whole expression, the parts which you could put parentheses around. Okay, this is very hard to communicate. Do you think you understood what I tried to say? So try to see the big shape. Like here, this is much more simple expression than this one. You figure out, you look at this, it's some kind of a, you know, we are summing two things. Then I can start looking at, this is the first thing that I'm summing, and figure out what that is. Then you figure out what that is. So you can split your reading of Haskell expression into smaller and smaller parts until it becomes clear. Okay, everyone is looking slightly worried. Yeah, you should be, this is hard. Okay, now you. And yeah, I have really a rotten way of formatting this exercise. But I have this very nasty-looking long Haskell expression. And now I'm asking you, how does this expression divide into sub-expressions? So there's two division operators. I have different colors with these. So, yes? Oops. Okay, so you have to look at the slides. And I promise you not to use colored clouds anymore during this course. Yeah, this doesn't work really in English. What did you do on functional programming course? Yeah, we did clouds. You know, translate this into Finnish. They were nice colors. And, you know, I think for you, all of these are obvious, yes. The final choice is that this is syntax error. And yeah, so. Okay, everyone cast their vote yet? Hands up if you need more time. Yeah, more time. Let's give a few minutes or 1 minute more time. Okay, that's your 1 minute. Cast your votes now. 3 more seconds to press the buttons. And we get quite an even spread. Like I said, this is a difficult question. Should be difficult. All that we can say is probably not going to be this function call. This is actually, I think, what the programmer in the expression intended to write. It's probably something like this. But then again, we have 4 choices that could be it. Most prominently, okay, this is a syntax error, it's not a valid Haskell expression, let's not think about this. And then this one, it's the first division that splits the expression apart, second division that splits the expression apart, and then these 3 clouds, where there's a function call with 2 arguments. Okay. In a group. No, short discussion. Ops, niinpä onkin. Joo, oot oikeassa. Ei mahan nyt mitään, mutta se on väärin sitten.
Se tosiaan, mä laskin tähän niin kuin, haluaisin laskea ensin tuonne itse 2 vai sitten jakaa sen 12. Sitten ei ole
päässyt.
Yep. But I want to understand how it's worked. So I see it as like that. It's a tangent to it's like it will take y because it will stop because it's of the operator, and then it will take this 2 value as a division between those two.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I can't see what's the operation here. It's
no. It's one of these divisions, since you have. Either you put parentheses around this part, you divide something by 45, or you put parentheses around this part, and, this part here, and you divide something by 45. So, we'll play with this expression on the... Joo, hokasi just, olit oikeassa. Se on väärin tehtävä. Okay, I think I have a typo here. This 45 here should be the pi. I think I typed this wrong. But Okay. Still thinking, I guess. Okay, everyone thought enough. Hands up if you need more time. Yeah, let's have a minute more. And I think I have a typo in this part here. Sorry about that. So basically look at these more than the explanations. Okay, I think it's enough with this exercise. So, what do we get? So, this boils down to this judgment, whether, which one of these division operators is the primary symbol, or how the parentheses go around these things. And, yeah, it's a bit troublesome since I had small typo here, which I fix later on. But let's see together as a group how this actually works. So, I have 8 and 2 function defined. And do I have pi? Yeah, I have both of them. So, first thing to ask, is this a syntactically valid Haskell? Is this grammatically correct to say this thing? It's probably going to be, give us a wrong result. And to check if something is grammatically correct in Haskell, you can always ask GHI to give me a type for this. If it's grammatically correct, it's going to have some kind of a type. However, when we look at the type, it's going to claim some very strange things. It's going to say that A has to be, it's a function from A to A. How is this function from A to A? Something is really going wrong here. A has to be a floating point number, and then this kind of function of two arguments has to be a number. And this kind of function must be a fractional number, and this t, which doesn't even appear anywhere, it's going to be a floating point number. So, yeah, it is grammatically correct Haskell. However, it's nonsense according to the type. The type, well, if I would define how this kind of function is a number and this kind of function is a fractional number, then you could actually compute this expression. But as it stands, it won't compute. Now, then the question is, what is the possible parenthesization of this? If I start adding parentheses, well, first I have this function call. And yeah, there's a pi. Pi is an argument for this function call. Then there is this operator here. Operators are not arguments for functions. So we have to put parentheses in here also. Then let's... Okay. Luckily, I have this low technology equivalent of Haskell compiler with me. So let's try again. The font is infinitely worse with this low-tech version. 8 and 2 pi, and then divided by 12 pi divided by 45. Okay, can I add any more parentheses to this thing? It's an abomination, it's not going to work. But no, some of you is going, someone of in this classroom is going to write this kind of abomination in GHI one point, and it's going to be terribly lost. So let's figure out how we can get ourselves back on the map. Then, anything else that we recognize here? Yeah, we have this part here. That's a function call. That is calling function 12 with argument pi. I don't know what is pi of 12. It's probably not going to make any sense, yes? Yeah, you can't define a function that starts with a number, but you can certainly call a function. So basically what happens here, that is the reason why we have this constraint. This number 12, what is number 12 when I type it into the GHI? It's anything, 12 is, it is not int, it's not float. It's anything that has this type class num. So basically I can overload numbers. They're already overloaded, so I can write 12 and it's an int if I need an int, and it's double if I need a double. But in Haskell this is open-ended. So I could probably overload functions to be numbers also. So 12 would mean some weird function. So this is why we get this function part. Okay, back to this. Now, we could put parentheses around this part, like this. Or we could put, I don't have colors, so let's put thicker parentheses. Oh, wait. Like this. So I could parenthesize this side or this side. How do I determine which way the parentheses go? Well, this really needs the computer because... Can I get it? No. Yeah, it works. So how do I determine the order of parentheses here? I have this nice info command on GHI. And it tells me, among other things, what is the type of the thing that I'm asking info for. It tells me where the thing is defined, and it tells me the precedence and associativity of this element. So infix L, it's left associative, meaning that if I type something like this, the parentheses are grouping on the left. This is, if you forget what is left associative, what is right associative, you can always go and try. So does it parenthesize on that way or that way? Yeah, well, if you add parentheses here, you change the meaning also. So it means that parentheses go on the starting part first, on the first division, meaning that the right way of parenthesizing this weird abomination is to put parentheses here and here. No, like I said, it's a very awkward thing. But this is something that you have to spend a few moments when you are learning Haskell. Any questions about this? This is an excellent question to put on Slack if you haven't done the exercise where you have to ask a question on Slack. There's plenty of things to put it out. Okay, so the question there, none of the answers were correct. I tried to tell you that, you know, this part, I have a typo there, so sorry about that. I made you think without purpose. But anyways, principally, the answer, as you can see, these were the correct parentheses. It should have been this one. but then I typoed this line. Sorry about this. But like I said on the first lecture, each of my lecture slides will contain at least one error. So here's your one error for the day. And this, you know, don't panic. This always happens in my courses, so it's not a big deal. So everyone agrees that this is hard. There is one another example. We are not going to do this now. You do that at home or think about this, and the remote students don't have to answer it. But, you know, this is some part of the code of these lecture slides. The lecture slides are written in Haskell because I'm crazy that way. And it's pretty much reflecting on if you have deep nested Haskell expression, what it's going to look like. And you have these, you know, parentheses over parentheses. It's very, you know, big and complex. And this is the reason why you have to, you know, figure out how function calls, associativity, precedence, and parentheses interact. This is your main goal for the, you know, following week. If you get that, you are very well on way of becoming an excellent Haskell programmer. This is the main early difficulty in Haskell. In a few weeks, this is, of course, obvious to everyone. But, yeah. So, how do you get this thing? There's three things that define what is the principal operator. If you have parentheses, you know, add as many parentheses as you can, and things will be obvious, always. Then check the associativity and the precedence. How do you check it? Well, you use the info command, and you get either infix L or infix R. L is left, R is right, and the precedence level. Precedence level is the thing in which order you have to compute these. If you mix different kind of operators, then those with higher precedence are computed first. And my advice to every one of you, do not mix operators. Just put parentheses when you are, you know, mixing several operators. So instead of writing something like this, you are mixing operators here. I mean, do yourself and your coworkers a favor and put the parentheses where they belong. It makes things much easier in Haskell. Of course, with this small expression, there's not much of a difference. But if you get, you know, big bunch of operators, just do this. And yeah, functions have the highest precedence. So if you can make a function call, that is a function call or function application. Yeah. And then we have to, you know, postpone this topic to the next lecture. I don't think anyone minds. We can, of course, spend half an hour now and do this right here. But does anyone want to spend half an hour and do this? Yeah, thought so. So, finally, any questions? Yes?
Is there some way to see how many actually got correctly after the lecture? Would it be possible to, like, have some kind of way to tell how many of the lecture books you actually got correctly?
Yeah, currently there is no way of telling how many lecture questions you got correct. But if you got some correct, it's okay, and don't worry about it. And I will figure out a way to make statistics. One question for you. Do you want the high score list of these?
No.
Yeah, I thought so. Any other questions? Finally, if you, you know, want me to go over some topics during the lectures, or, you know, code an example program, or do anything else than these peer instruction things, you have to ask, but I will be happy to deliver. Otherwise, have a nice evening, and we see you tomorrow.